Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, if you allow me, I'll offer some reflections on the Dhamma. And as I always say, these reflections are for just that, not for believing or disbelieving, but actually just for reflecting on. And if they're helpful, good. If they're not, that's okay. And the tradition I come from is an oral tradition, actually. I mean, I've studied the texts a little bit, but much of my teaching has been through teachers in Thailand and England and so on. So it's an oral tradition is interesting because it, a one-on-one situation, it really is contacting the person in a way which is very, very relevant, and the teaching's very, very specific. And teaching sometimes can be addressing one aspect but miss another aspect of life. So I might talk about letting go and one makes sense, but one person might interpret that as being slovenly or something like that. So the reflection is always that capacity to say, well, where does this fit in my life? Or does it fit in my life? Rather than saying it's kind of absolutely right or absolutely wrong, that sense of relativeness. One of the words that you find a lot in Buddhism is the word attachment. And there's lots of good Buddhist jokes about downloading your attachments and so on. And so it's a word that I think it's misunderstood. One of the ways I think it's misunderstood is the idea that somehow preferences are attachment. You know, I prefer coffee to tea, or I prefer warm to cold, or whatever, as if one lives a life somehow totally bland and has no preferences. But that preferences are just that. We all have preferences. That's just the nature of consciousness. But attachment was always a sign of suffering. When attachment is a part of consciousness, then there's some suffering going on. Right? So that's the sign. So if I prefer a nice spring day and then there's snow tomorrow, right? And I can say I prefer that, but I don't have to suffer about the snow. I could see my mind moving there, saying, oh, Ottawa, wah. And that would be the suffering, wouldn't it? So that would be the attachment. Yeah. So the ways that texts talk about attachment, one of the ways is sensuality, and that's a very broad topic. One of the ways is views and opinions, ways of attachment. One of the ways is usually defined as a superstition, but my teacher also talks about kind of cultural assumptions, which are attachments. And then what underpins all attachment is what we call attachment to self-view, ego, personality view. And so if we just take that example of snow tomorrow, I just got mum a bunch of plants, so a frost is the last thing I need. Let's say that there's a frost and I haven't taken all the plants in and they're all in pots and the next morning the plants are half dead. Now that's called an unpleasant experience, right? And the first aspect of attachment is around that pleasant and unpleasant. That's just a given of being a sense being. When you're in a sense body and you have emotions and you have sensory input at the sense doors, pleasant and unpleasant, attractive and unattractive are just part of being human, aren't they? But this particular unattractiveness of the frozen plants that I'm now experiencing has a hook in it, doesn't it? It's that I don't want these plants to die. It costs money, and I don't want to go to as much as I enjoy the market, etc., etc. So I have a sort of expectation or a hope, right? And then I get disappointed by life, and that disappointment is not universal. Either the person, oh, it's just a frost, no problem. I haven't bought any plants yet. So there's a kind of personal investment in it or whatever. So the unpleasant is sometimes it's just in the nature of things, but sometimes it's in the nature of my preferences. So I prefer not to have the frost, and then the frost comes, and then what do I do with that? And that's the challenge of practice, isn't it? You know, the unpleasantness of that first image, dead plants, hits me, and then what do I do with it? Now, if I'm really mindful and I'm present and I understand the Dharma, then I just stay with that unpleasant feeling. And that's hard to do. Why? Because the mind so quickly grasps that. This is the idea of grasping or attachment. It grasps that with thought. And then the thinking begins to create a sense of, oh God, you stupid idiot, why did you buy those plants anyways? And I don't want to live in auto. And, you know, it goes on. And that's suffering, isn't it? And that's the fourth of these attachments. It's called attavada upadana, which is the attachment to self-view, or what we call narrative now. And it's a very good thing in our modern culture where many of us talk about and drop the narrative and know the situation, say, whatever way we talk about it. And that's quite an important thing to understand. So the narrative is something that I'm adding to something that's disappointing. Analysis of, well, next year don't do that. That's fine. Don't do that. Make sure you never buy your plants before, or whatever. But that analysis isn't suffering, is it? It's just cause and effect, making decisions, becoming more skillful. That's a part of living a skillful life. But that sting of thought with the aversion or the self-disparagement, whatever, that narrative, that bit, that's the attachment, and that's the suffering. Now, the thing about attachment, it is also nutriment, because it feeds more suffering, right? Another kind of suffering. So if I suffer, if I have a particular habit of self-disparagement, right? And so then there's some disappointment or some failure, then that is grasped through self-view, through self-thinking, through narrative thinking, and then that is another kind of self. Oh, terrible, stupid fool, you did this and you did that, and the mind goes on and on and on. And so you can see an untrained mind just ricochet from one mode of attachment to another. And when the attachment isn't great, it's just kind of low level. So I like to joke about low-level whinging. He's just sort of just enough in the background. It doesn't really hurt. And then something really strong happens, and that same habit then, because it's been indulged in, it grabs your mind. So let's say if someone has a tendency to low-level whinging, heaven forbid, but let's say that takes place, just kind of in the back of the mind. And then something really serious happens, some really serious loss or disappointment. What's the mind been trained to do, or what's the mind been conditioned to do? It's been conditioned to go to some negative attitude, self-view narrative, right? And then, then it really takes, and then it really hurts, then it really hurts. So it's very important to train all the time, not just in the extremes of life, to train all the time. So if you think about, like, sensuality, where we have preferences and where attachment takes place, it can be in all kinds of ways. If you just take the example of meditation and discomfort, If anyone who has developed meditation knows that that's one of the things you face in meditation, is the natural discomfort of a body sitting, trying to sit still for 45 minutes. Right? And one of the lessons, early lessons in meditation, is to learn to be patient with discomfort rather than to react to it. Now that discomfort is negative, like it's unpleasant, right? But what attachment, if you look at attachment, what happens is you start to think about the clock, don't you? Or you start to think about moving. Should I move? Should I not move? Did he say we could move? Or you move once, and then it's uncomfortable again. And then you move 30 seconds later, and it's uncomfortable again. And you start to get into a kind of a dance rather than sitting still. So discomfort, you know, just that little thing, discomfort in meditation, can be a very helpful lesson in kamapadana, in attachment to sensuality. Attachment to sensuality, you might think, well, that's just about hedonism. Yeah, well, there's that. But there's just the ordinariness that much of our life is pleasant and much of our life is unpleasant. This is a given. And to find the peace of the mind, we don't have to just blindly endure the unpleasant, but we do have to know how to recognize it as just that. It's just that. And so that's one of the lessons that one learns in meditation. So if your meditation, say, like some of the lessons I learned in Thailand, I often talk about that, where I'd be sitting on concrete floors for 2-3 hours, 3-4 hours sometimes, and no cushions, just the little thin cloth. And quite a lot of physical discomfort. Now, I could leave any time, but that wasn't the etiquette. So, you know, hang in there. I could move. But the more I moved on it, the more I react to it, the more I wanted to move. So I began to say, okay, what does it really feel like, this discomfort? Not in a way I was hurting myself, because the teachers didn't encourage that, but just, can you just be patient with discomfort, with hardness? Yeah? And that was a really insightful thing. I mean, I was pretty thick. I had to see it again and again and again. But just, so what's the problem here, Viradhammo? Well, it's hard. I actually, when I became a monk, I didn't know how to meditate. I had never done a retreat. I had never been part of a Buddhist group. I just went into it kind of cold. And I never knew about cushions until 5 years later. Honestly, I didn't. Because in Thailand, the only guy that got a cushion was the abbot, and his was like little thin thing. But like look at now, I've had this kind of posh wedge. It's very nice. So it was just, that's what you do. You just sit on concrete, which is probably helpful. You know, had I had a kind of cushion experience in my meditation, I might have longed for it. But just, you know, you take that as a, like, this is how you learn about yourself, right? Is to learn about, like, some really fundamental thing in human consciousness is discomfort. We have so much discomfort, don't we? We have emotional discomfort. We have, you know, people impinging on us in unkind ways, slandering us, or just being harsh or crude, or that's very unpleasant, isn't it? The body experiences a lot of unpleasantness, and as you get older, so there's just that. That seems to me a huge lesson to learn: is how can I be at peace with the unpleasant? Not to take it as a kind of ascetic vow that I must always have the unpleasant, that kind of self-mortification, not that, but just the very ordinariness of discomfort, unpleasantness. Now, awareness can know that, but you have to be very patient, don't you? And why am I impatient? Because I prefer the pleasant. So preferring the pleasant is natural. Who would prefer the unpleasant? Well, that's just natural. But always needing the pleasant as opposed to the unpleasant and being attached to that leads to a very restless mind. And a mind which never realizes the deep peace of silence and emptiness of the mind, because it's always reacting to the pleasant and the unpleasant. And because we don't have control over much of the environment, much of our body, we have a little bit of control, we have a little bit of input, but much of it we can't control. That means that we can have a lot of fear or aversion, or we're always trying to control things and get them set up in ways which are very comfortable. In an affluent society, we have a lot of chance to do that. But when you're out of your, as we say, out of your comfort zone, literally, like say when people come on a 10-day retreat, to some extent it's a relief. You know, it's a relief to not have the complexities of work. But oftentimes people, they don't have email. Or like in the monastery, we don't have ground. We have instant coffee. Can you imagine in Canada? Instant coffee. Now for us in Thailand, that was ambrosia. If I get a cup of coffee, like once a year, it was huge. But in the monastery, we decided that if people want coffee, we put out instant coffee, but we don't put out the finest whatever. And a few people really reacted. One person left the monastery. I said, what do you think this is? Starbucks? But it was interesting to see how important this coffee was. It was really fascinating. I mean, the person came back with deep embarrassment. They're fine. But it was just that kind of, what do you mean, no? I'm not... So in our practice, when those things happen, and when somehow we get hit from the side in some way, it's unexpected, and we react, that's where we try to bring the practice in. And what we try to do is just know this is the reaction and not take it to the narrative. Now, thinking about things which have been unlawful or illegal or abusive, that's we have to do that. I'm not talking about that social part. I'm just talking about that inner part of where we're trying to discover peace, where we're trying to go beyond these limitations. Shopping, say, that's a kind of interesting sensual delight, isn't it? How good this culture is in making things look like if you own them, you will be happy. They do it very well, don't they? And they make cars look sexy and iPods look sexy, you know, whatever, and there's the kind of feeling, well, if I have that, if I own that, I'll be happy. And then people buy it, and they forget about it. And they forget that actually it didn't quite work, and they buy another one. And it's very interesting how good our culture has done that to delude us. Yeah? And you can see how, and it's a kind of boring topic, but to watch that in your mind, how when I'm attracted to something pleasant, my mind kind of thinks, well, if I own that, I'll always feel pleasant. Whether it's a person or a mind state or whatever, this is the kind of idea. Well, if I own that, then I'll always have this pleasant feeling. So then I try to acquire it and hold it and keep it, emotional states or whatever. But of course, when I have it, all of a sudden, it doesn't give the same hit anymore. Or the hit goes, it changes, because of the law of change. And same with the unpleasant. The unpleasant's the other way. It's like the discomfort in the body. It feels like, if I don't get rid of this discomfort, I'm going to blow up. Or, this is really bad. And it's not necessarily verbal. It's like, I don't want the unpleasant. So the unpleasant we need to somehow bring in. Not, again, I'm not saying like hurt yourself, but somehow we need to bring it in. It's okay. And the pleasant, we need to see, well, it's limited. It's okay, and I'm grateful that it's pleasant right now, but it's limited. That's not nibbana. That's not the deathless. That's conditioned. And that's a different attitude to pleasant and unpleasant. That's a wise attitude. It's a reflective attitude. And it's not grasping the pleasant and unpleasant. It's not denying it. So you find in a life lived in contemplation and reflection, when life is pleasant, it tends to be gratitude rather than a desire for ownership. And when life is unpleasant, then there tends to be more patience. This will change, rather than aversion or fear. And those are the signs. And again, like going back to my early years in Thailand, I had a lot of unpleasantness. It wasn't like hurtful, it wasn't life-threatening, people were very kind to me, but just like a hot climate. like the hot season in Thailand, wow, it's just like, my mind just felt like a ton of bricks. It was just so heavy. Try to meditate. Oh. So this kind of being with something just very, very unpleasant, no distraction, was actually quite good for me. And just to be, not be really, not much samadhi, that was out the window, forget it. Watch your breath, forget it. It's more like, can you just survive? And just watching the whinging mind, and it's so hot, it's so hot. I'd say, well, that, you know, I can't change the heat, because there was no air conditioning, and you had to be a monk of about 20 years to get a fan. That was when you had a fan, you kind of made it. So, okay, what are you going to do? You either leave the monastery, or you quit whinging. But it wasn't so easy, because the habit of whinging was something that I had indulged in. So that's the work, isn't it? You know, there's the situation, and this is why we said, this is the way it is now. Life feels this way. And what am I adding to it? What am I adding? Oh, this hot season is awful. Where's the coffee? So then to actually like be with the unpleasant, just be with the unpleasant, then it brings you to a sense of equanimity. Right? You have to be very patient and accepting and open, right? It's not like some kind of control thing. But you see that you can't sustain aversion to the unpleasant unless you think about it. If you consider, if you have aversion to someone in your family or someone at work, right? Notice how to sustain the aversion, you have to keep thinking about that negative aspect of the person. And if the person is near you, they supply it all the time. But you do have to keep looking at that aspect, don't you? You know, so the person somehow maybe leaves, you know, something major, like leaves the teacup dirty in the sink, right? There's something really important. And you're a really tidy person. And this person always leaves a teacup. They always do that. What do you have to do? You have to focus on that aspect of the person. Everything else goes out the window, and there's only the teacup person. And that's the way aversion works. You have to take the narrative, and you have to keep repeating it, believing in it. If you have some sense of self-disparagement towards yourself, something that you might have done in the past or perceived you have done, right? Some fault in the shape of your nose or some aspect of your work skills or whatever it is, right? To really hold self-aversion, you have to keep reinforcing that perception. You know, my hairline is receding. Or something silly like that. But it's not silly. It hurts. It's a kind of self-hurting. So notice that kind of narrative. That's attachment, isn't it? You have to keep holding a kind of perspective. And that's what we called attachment to views, which is called ditupadana. Attachment to perceptions, attachment to positions. We see it in politics. We see it in all kinds of things. But this kind of holding to a viewpoint. Now some people in Buddhism will think, well, you shouldn't have any views. But that's not Buddhism. Buddhism is right view. And right view, as Ajahn Sumedho likes to say, right view is not righteous view. Right? So let's say in Buddhism, we would say that if you follow anger, you're going to get an unskillful result, right? Now someone might come to me and say, well, you know, I need to express my anger. And someone came to me like that, and they were talking about that each time they had anger, they expressed it. And they've been doing this for 10 years. And I said, yeah, but are you beyond it? Now if I held to the position that, no, you know, Buddhism says this, that becomes righteous view. I'm right, you're wrong. But to say there is no view, to say that, oh yeah, I mean, if you want to do anger, fine. Fine, yeah, but there's a result. So there's the law of karma. So some kind of, you know, relativism, like, you know, whatever you do is fine, darling, that's not Buddhism. What you do has consequences. But for me to hold to that, I'm right and you're wrong, and you know, I'm a monk and you don't know what you're doing, you know, all that kind of ego stuff, that's attachment to views. or even the view, you're always right, I'm always wrong. That's attachment to views, views and opinions. So this is a very, very deep source of suffering in humanity, isn't it? The things that humans have done for in the name of political ideologies and continue to do is and religious ideologies. It's appalling, isn't it? And it's just a thought. It's just a position. That position might come from all kinds of abusive things in childhood and so on. Who knows where they come from? So there can be sources of that. But that holding to a position, right? Argumentation, self-righteousness, snobbery. Like sometimes you see people who are language snobs. You ever met a language snob? Their English is better than your English? You know, they're going to... You use the word wrong. Language snob. All kinds of stuff that people pick up. And then... But what the sign of suffering is like, especially that kind of viewpoint, is alienation. You know, when I look at you as lesser or whatever, then and I'm superior, or I look at myself as lesser and you're superior because your Canadian accent is more cool. that sense of self again, that's the attachment, isn't it? So the viewpoint, right view of Buddhism is that we are all brothers and sisters in old age, sickness, and death. This is the common ground that we all want to, the golden rule, we all want to be happy. So may you be happy, may I be happy. We all don't like pain. May you be free from pain, may I be free from pain. That's right view. That's right view. And that's not righteous, is it? It's just right view. That's this, because that right view leads to liberation from suffering, leads to liberation from alienation, leads to liberation from conceit and that, and all those things. So, views and opinions, it's vast, isn't it? All the positions we take around people, the judgments we make about people, judgments we make about ourselves, what's, and all the rest of it. So in a Buddhist culture, there are moral rules, we have rules and so on. In monasticism, we have a very strong rule that we all live by. And let's say if someone transgresses a major rule, say if a monk were to rob the monastery, say if a monk, I've never seen it, but if a monk kind of embezzled money and went to the pub one night or something like that, then that monk would have to disrobe. As soon as that had happened, the monk is out. You're out. It's called a defeat offense, or stealing. Now, the monk could come in, oh, you're just attached. You're just attached to Buddhist rules. Yeah, maybe, but you're out. So people will use that kind of argument. No, you're just attached. No, there is social consequences to what you did. And that's not attachment, that's agreement. Attachment would be then if I hated the person or looked down on them. Oh, you pathetic robber. Right? The compassion is still appropriate, but so is disrobing. Right? So sometimes people will mistake this kind of attachment to views as being just some kind of laissez-faire, that whatever you do is fine. You know, if robbing and killing is your thing, you go for it. And it's silly. So there are consequences, and that's the law of karma. And the law of karma is just in the nature of things, isn't it? When I function from compassion, I get a certain kind of wholesome result. When I function from anger, I get an unwholesome result. And that's not like just an opinion I'm banging out. It's something I notice in my own mind. And that's a right view, really, becomes insight. It's come from insight rather than just book learning. You just know. You just know for yourself if there are consequences in this particular way. The third of these, and again, they're always underpinned by self view or narrative view or ego view, whatever way you like to use that language. The third one is silabhata paramasa, silabhata upadana. It's called in Pali, and it is usually translated as a belief in rites and rituals. So a belief that somehow through some kind of external doing, I'm going to be liberated from suffering. So, kind of grossly say, if I think that by bowing to this shrine that I'm somehow going to get enlightened or make merit just by the physical activity, then that's attachment to a ritual, a kind of blindness. But if I see that bowing is a way of composing my mind, is a way of using iconography for reflection, is a way of like a corporate activity which brings harmony and so on, then it's not attachment to a ritual, it's a ritual which is used with skill. Right? So rituals in themselves are not bad. Superstitions. So the example I like to give, and I've often given it, but there is a cultural habit in Thailand of people wearing little Buddha amulets. So they get these lovely little Buddha amulets, and then they put them in little cases, and they have a gold necklace or something, and they wear them. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that in Buddhism. It can be a kind of reminder of the path. But unfortunately, many people take them as power objects. Soldiers who wear them thinking, you know, it'll protect them from the AK-47s, which is a dangerous view. But this is a very interesting example. There was a woman in Thailand, in New Zealand, a Thai woman, and she went swimming, and she had one of these amulets, and she thought it was very, very powerful, and she lost it. And boy, was she frightened. She was just so afraid. This is what superstition does, doesn't it? You know, it's based on fear. I have this, and it protects me, but I've never looked at the fear. And, oh, she had a hard time. She got another one. And I really, you know, I didn't have good command. I don't have command of Thai at all, but I tried to talk her through knowing fear, but I didn't have the language for it. So fear was the problem. So that, you know, you can see that, and you think, well, I'm not superstitious, so on. But a broader way of looking at it is like cultural expectations. Fashion. I mean, poor women have to wear these shoes. I just think that's torture. To have to walk on heels. I mean, that's worse than foot binding in China. And yet, people do it. So, what is that? It's some kind of cultural norm which people pick up and go for it. And they think that whatever, but that's an attachment, right? Or a breakage. Break your ankle. So, you know, that those are kind of extremes. But kind of like maybe, say, maybe there are some, like, maybe viewpoints in feminism. So maybe, I mean, feminism gone through all kinds of interesting and helpful changes, but maybe at one point there was a viewpoint that you shouldn't be a mother at home, right? Becomes a kind of cultural norm. So the mother wants to be at home with her kids, maybe. It's just a kind of example, maybe. She wants to be at home with the mother, but she feels kind of guilty. You know, if I'm really part of this feminist movement, I shouldn't be a mother at home. Cultural pressure. Like for me, because I live as a monastic, I know the kind of cultural pressures I have come from certain kind of role models. Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mani, these are very, very great teachers with their great attainments and tremendous fortitude and so on. And then that might be a kind of cultural group ethic, which then I try to emulate, rather than being authentic and saying, well, no, I got my own karma to work with. I got my own stuff to work with. I can't be Ajahn Chah, and I'm not the Buddha, that's for sure. But I could take those role models and just try to be like that. And so we have all the shoulds and shouldn't be's. So I'm raised by a family, maybe, and I'm, you shouldn't be this and you shouldn't be that. You shouldn't be angry and you should be this. And then all that comes up, doesn't it? I shouldn't be this way. So there's a whole kind of construct of what I should be and what I shouldn't be. And then I begin to interpret my own life through those attachments. And you get the same attavada coming up again, the same self-view. Oh, shouldn't be like this, I shouldn't be angry. So for me, in the monastery, there's tremendous emphasis on compassion and kindness and right speech, and the standards for compassion are so high in Buddhism. They're really very high. So, so there's that, and there's squeaky me beginning, right? My knees are killing me, and I'm hating everyone in the monastery. I want to get out. And then someone says to me, "You should be more compassionate." I want to kill you. Be more anger. And that's a kind of cultural expectation. Whereas what Buddhism is saying is, well, anger feels this way, don't attach to it. Now that's different than saying you should feel kind. It's a whole different ballgame, isn't it? So one could see a lot of those kinds of constructs in the mind that come up. And each of us will have different kind of familial conditioning, gender conditioning, and so on and so forth. But the fourth of these, the one that underpins all this, is self-view, or narrative, or personality view, or ego, or whatever. And it's that constant voice just going on, the drone of self. Just goes on, it just keeps picking something up, complaining, worrying, fantasizing. It's always a sense of me and time and all of that. But that can be known as an object. It's hard, isn't it? So, again, if we come back to the example of just discomfort. So you're meditating, you're trying to be here for 45 minutes in a quiet way, and then you start to feel discomfort, like maybe like 15 minutes into it, say. Okay? Heaven forbid. And you've been here before, and you know you've got your best cushion, right? And you've done your yoga beforehand, so you've set it all up, and you know it's going to be 45 minutes, and you know I tend to stick with the 45 minutes, so 15 minutes, and unfortunately look at your clock. That's a bad move, and that makes you even more restless, right? And then the narrative starts, the story starts. Oh God, I don't know. I just leave. Yeah, but then, I don't know. He said I should stick it out. And blah, 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 blah. Right? And that's attachment. And then what's the practice? Is like, how can I awaken the mind away from that into the way things are? Oh, that's thought. That's worry. What am I worrying? Oh, yeah, it's the body. What's the body? What discomfort? Oh, be patient. Now, that's right thinking. That's not attached thinking. Like it's like coaching yourself or training yourself, huh? Just be patient. I wonder where it's really uncomfortable. What if I breathe into it? So you can use thought, but now you're doing it mindfully rather than just as a reaction. So the reaction or the attachment is always self-view, me and time. So time is very, very important. So attachment to the discomfort with me thinking about when's the bell going to ring? When am I going to get out of here? How long can I sit? Should I move? As opposed to, okay, this is discomfort. How do we relax with it? Just be patient. And that's very good. That's right thinking. So in Buddhism, we don't have no thinking. No thinking is good. I mean, it's good to know the mind without thought. But right thinking is very important. And that comes from right understanding. Attachment is wrong thinking. And negative thinking. Ego thinking. And all the baggage that creates. And all the suffering that creates. So attachment is quite a... an important topic in Buddhism, again, it's not saying that you can't have preferences. It's just saying that's a way of talking about the suffering of the mind, and that we can't let go of that. So we have our preferences, and when we don't get them, we see what happens. What happens to the mind? Do we move with equanimity, or do we react with aversion and fear, or distraction, whatever it might be? All right. I'll leave that for your contemplation.